Peggy, I get some of your stories from a friend of mine, BJ Lechoon. She made
Oh, yeah,
she
I know
probably
BJ.
subscribes to you, but we put a little magazine together called the Good Cheer Magazine, and I
Yes.
have been putting your stories in our magazine. The very first section is called general, what's it called? General information, something like that. We've had what, maybe five or six of your stories that you've written about people and that are blind and their unusual past and their accomplishments and stuff. So, I thought this would be a neat subject for our information station call, and I told Deanne about it, and so here you are. So welcome.
Well, thank you. I am familiar with Good Cheer magazine and know some people who got it. And I would be glad to put whoever is in charge of Good Cheer on my email list so that you get it directly. So
Well, that
BJ
would be
doesn't have
neat. That would
well,
be neat. So you can send it to me anytime
and
you want.
that and here's how we can arrange that. In fact, anybody can join my mailing list. excuse me, I have about 1,000 subscribers. My email list, all you have to do is shoot me an email to theblindhistorylady@gmail.com. That's theblindhistorylady@gmail.com, all one word. And I will be glad to add you to my list. I have been doing this for, 8 years at least now. I'd have to go back and look and see when my first one was. I was telling everybody 5 years, and then it dawned on me it had been like seven. So I have been writing these monthly emails and sending them out because I think it's very important for us to know our history as blind people. I grew up in the blind community. I was raised in North Dakota and Minnesota. My mother was blind. And I knew the blind piano tuners and rug weavers and door-to-door salesmen as I was growing up. And most of them did not lead what I would call impressive lives as I thought of it at that time. It wasn't until I got much older that I realized those were the people whose shoulders all of us were standing on. I was given the task in the 1970s to clean out the file cabinets and boxes of material out of the Home for the Blind in St. Paul, Minnesota. And the reason I was given that task, number one, I think because nobody else wanted to do it, but number two is that because I had grown up in the blind community, they said, you're going to recognize more names than the rest of us are going to recognize, and you're going to know what's important. And they said, by the way, it all has to go into one file cabinet because we are moving into 1,000 square feet for our new office, and that's all we can take. And I'm telling you, there were three or four filing cabinets in the office and more in the basement and boxes all over the place. So I threw out a lot of stuff, which I truly regret to this day. And when I was going through a lot of that material, I would stop every once in a while and check out, gee, what is this? And I came across a letter that was written in the 1920s, and it was from one board member to another. Oh, let me explain that the Minnesota State Organization of the Blind, which was what it was called in that time, was formed in 1919. And so it had a continuous history, to this day, actually. That organization, their primary goal was to build a home for the blind where blind people could rent space, conduct their businesses, and have a meaning. Because in St. Paul, and Minneapolis, many places would not rent to a blind person. Many places would not give a mortgage to a blind person if they wanted to buy a home. So the goal was to raise enough money to buy the property and build this home, which they did. Opened the home just a little bit before the crash of 1929. And so that didn't bode well for the home for several years. But anyway, back to the letters. So I was reading this one letter, and it's from one board member saying that he met with our blind congressman over the Robbins bill. Well, at that time, I thought I kind of knew it all about blindness in Minnesota because I'd grown up in the community and heard the old folks talk all the time and so on and so forth. So this kind of took me by surprise. I had no idea there had ever been a blind congressman, let alone that it had come from Minnesota. Naturally, in the letter, there was no name. Everybody just sort of knew who it was at the time. So I put that aside and I was a little more careful. It took me a lot longer to go through the piles after that. Because I wanted to see, is there something else I should be saving? And then about 15, 20 years later, I worked on a 75th anniversary history for the organization. And we had recorded some of the material at that time and had every one of the newsletters and all of the minutes going through about 1990 at that time. And it took me about 2.5 years to go through that material, take notes, and write up the little vignettes and so on. So I got interested in trying to find out who that blind congressman was. And it turns out his name was Thomas David Shaw. And I call him my first ancestor. I have looked at our blindness history as a genealogical project in many respects. Around 2000, I had decided I needed a project to keep me busy over the winter and decided I was going to do my family tree. Somebody had done a family tree on one side of my family, and I got a hold of it and thought, geez, I wonder what it'd be like to do the rest of the family. And I found a partial tree somewhere else. Ancestry.com was just getting started at that time, and I subscribed to it. I took a lot of classes on how to research your family history, and many of the classes were designed for teaching you how to research without or with minimal help from the internet. So I learned a lot about how to dig around. One of the things that they tried to teach us was basically how to use a reader. And so I was already a step ahead of the game because I'd already been using readers as a blind person. So I thought this is kind of an interesting concept, but they gave me a lot of ideas. And I found that, if you are a member of a genealogical society and you call up someplace in Oregon, another genealogical society or a library group, with a donation or two, you might be able to get them to do an awful lot of work for you, type up an awful lot of stuff, and then it comes in an accessible format. So I have been fortunate in gathering up these genealogical skills for researching our blind ancestors. I have been working on my family tree now since 2000. It's almost as addicting as chocolate, not quite, but almost. When I would get stuck on my family history, I would pull from this mounting pile of stuff a name of a blind person that I had found an article about, or a magazine story, or had interviewed somebody and they gave me this name. And I'd see what I could find out about them. I also, when researching my family, one of the things we were always told in the classes was always look to the side. That means that if you're researching your family tree, don't just go up and down the branches, but go to the side as well. Who are the neighbors? Because you might find out that that's where your great aunt Mildred married into. Or if you are trying to find a family member and they all moved from a town together, especially in the 1800s, they might have all moved as a community group. So knowing the names of the community people would help you to find the ancestors. And that has definitely been the same solution for looking for some of these blind people. If Great Aunt Mildred was blind and was living in Joe Schmo's house, if Joe Schmo passed away or they had to move, maybe Aunt Mildred went to live with the people next door. The blind lady went to live with a neighbor, and so that has helped me sometimes track people. But I wanted to talk some about some of the people that I have found from Indiana as well. I gave you a little bit of my background. I could go on for about another hour and a half on that, and you'd all get bored. And I know that from my family, because every once in a while, I swear to God, all they hear is wah, 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 wah. Anyway, I found it interesting that one of the first blind legislators that I ever found was from Indiana. His name was John Donnell, and he is from Decatur County. He served in the state legislature from 1878 to 1880, just one term. It's hard to track him a lot. I haven't found a lot of what he stood for, what he was a Republican. His family was very much pro-union, and his neighbors were not so much pro-union during the Civil War, and so there was some friction with his va father, with some of the community members. But he was a lawyer, and his dad, although not trained as a lawyer, was also a lawyer. He was, like I said, the first blind person that I found as a state rep for quite a while. So Indiana kind of came ahead of the curve when it came to electing people to government. I have found more people in some other states who have been elected to government, but Indiana has, I think, a decent amount of folks. For example, Frank Toombs, he was from Scottsbury, I'm sorry. And he was elected to city council in 1900. You've got several justices of the peace, like Thomas Cooper. He was from Boone, and he was elected justice of the peace in 1899. Everett Addington, he was from farmland. He was a Republican. He was in the House of Representatives. He was elected in 1923, but he died in office, and he was elected to go and improve the services for blind people within the state, to see to it that there was more funding. He had other issues as well, but he did campaign on blindness issues when he was running, and he died when he was like 30 years old. I mean, he was just a young guy, and he died while he was serving in office, so we don't really know what he would have done. But he seemed to have a lot of support from his homeland, his hometown. And some of you may be familiar with Thomas Hasbrouck from Indianapolis. He served as a representative from 1950 to 1954, state senator from 55 to 58. He served on the city council from Indianapolis. I have trouble saying that in Minneapolis. I don't know why. But when you combined your city government with the county government, back in the late 60s and so on, he was one of the leaders in getting all of that done and served as chair. He was in city county government for like 20 years. And I'm going to be having a story about him that will be coming out in several months that will chronicle more of his life. He was blinded in World War II. He never saw a battle. He actually was blinded while demonstrating a training mission for mines. He was going to show people how to disarm mines, and one of them went off and it left him blinded. He was newly wed. He became very depressed. If it wasn't for his wife and his mother, probably he would have really been in sad shape. But they basically said, "We're not giving up on you. You're not giving up on you." He refused. He was in the VA hospital for months and months on end. And he would refuse a lot of their services. And they would say, "Oh, no, mm-mm. If you're not going to take it from them, then you're going to take it from us." His mother taught him how to read and write in Braille enough to get him started, where he actually did take a few classes after that. She got him to play cards and got him to play with the Braille cards. Now, she was probably about two lessons ahead of him. She was learning it herself at the time. His wife said, "Well, I'm going to teach you how to type." He went back and worked for Eli Lilly for many, many years. He was in their steno pool, if you will, for a while, and then he got into public relations and so on. Another person that worked in government was Luke Walpole, and he was also a justice of the peace in Indianapolis. Now, he was justice of the peace, was elected in 1873. So he was another one. He came from a wealthy family. His dad was a lawyer. His brother was a lawyer. He didn't go to law school or didn't take law classes till later. But his father had a large library. He taught his boys the law. So you might say he got schooled by his dad. And back then, you didn't necessarily have to have a certificate from a law school to practice law. You just had to be pretty good at winning cases or solving legal problems for people, and he did that. He also went on to do other things. He went into real estate and so on. But like I said, he came from a wealthy family, so he had a great time at purchasing real estate, getting entree into places where he wanted to be, and so on. Now, the School for the Blind in Indianapolis, I'm sorry, in Indiana, the school was not at first very academic. It was more on getting people ready and prepared to move into the job market. So you got as much academic as possible at the time. And that's not unusual for schools for the blind at that time, the new schools, because you're talking about 1847 when the school was founded. Who were they going to get for teachers? Many of them were students who had graduated from Ohio, a lot of them, and came and helped organize schools like in Kentucky and Indiana and Iowa and Illinois and Nebraska. But again, like I said, there wasn't a lot of academics because there wasn't a lot of books. There wasn't the money for the books. They had New York Point in the school till, oh, probably in the late 70, 1870s when they incorporated Braille into some of that. So what they focused on, like I said, was getting a job. Getting a job meant music. Getting a job meant making brooms, chairs, and later on piano tuning. That was about in the 1870s sometime as well, when the piano tuning was introduced at the school. So they had a fair amount of blind broom makers in the state of Indiana. And we look at that as a stereotypical job most often from our point of view now. But you look at it from their point of view back then in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, 90s, this was money. This was an opportunity for them to own their own business. And I mean own their own business and hire sighted people to work in their business as well. Aaron Boyer is a good example. He was a broom maker. He lived from 1833 to 1903. He went to the school for the blind and learned to be a broom maker. I wrote about him several months back. His dad made liquor, and Aaron was far more religious and didn't want to do that as an occupation. He also had poor health, and making liquor was strenuous for his lungs. Anyway, so he becomes a broom maker, and he did the usual, trying to sell them door to door, but he ended up starting his own shop. By the time he died in 1903, he employed 25 or more sighted people. His sons took it over. One of his sons, who I find, I like to sometimes just check and see what the kids did, if they had children. One of his sons looked at a lot of the industrial homes for the blind and other broom shops, especially the ones that undercut his dad and his brother's firm after his dad died. He went to organize broom shops and mandate that they pay a living wage, especially for disabled people, particularly blind, and especially for women. And he found that many of his sons found that many of his shops that they were looking into hired women who couldn't speak English and were paying them just pennies, literally. And so he helped to organize a lot of the broom shops and became quite well known for his skill and his knowledge of the law regarding unionization and labor laws. So he did a fairly good job, as Aaron Boyer did a fairly good job of making a great living for his family. They had a very nice house. He raised his children. Some of them went to college. You have blind guys who were working as broom salesmen in Indiana. I can trace as far as 2016. So it was sort of a respectable career for many, many decades for blind guys to get into. A name that I have been researching for quite a while. He still's got holes in his life, so I just keep thinking he's got more to tell me, so I don't know what I'm going to write about him, but I find him fascinating. His name is Bert Cutting, like Cutting, Cutting. Now, the first time he came to my attention was in about 19, 17, 18, around in there, because he was a secretary and he had learned to type, and he was a very fast typist. He lived from 1894 to 1972. He attended the Indiana School for the Blind. He went on to a trade school and became a really good typist. He was hoping to get a job in a big firm because he was very quick. He was very accurate. The First World War started. He did fairly well. The guys come home, and guess what? The returning soldiers get the job, and the blind guy doesn't. So he would sell brooms and rugs, and he did chair caning and all that kind of junk. He went to school to be a chiropractor, but found that it was just not the community was just not accepting him as a chiropractor. Well, one of the things that he did is they lived along rivers. And he would walk the riverbeds, and they would pick up shells and mussels and all that good junk. And so he'd sometimes find treasures. He became a diver, actually. He was so good at holding his breath under the ground, under the water. His kids would operate the little Johnny boat and go down the river. He rigged up a diving helmet for himself that he used a garden hose to breathe with, because he had a pump that his kids would air pump so he could stay down longer, that was attached to a similar diving bell helmet that divers used. And he thought, well, this isn't good because I got one kid up there constantly pumping, and they really shouldn't have to be doing all that. So he got this garden hose and he attached it to a little motor, and he was able to stay under the ground, under the water for a long time. One of the things that he is most known for is there was a trailer of cars that fell off of a bridge in the 1940s. And the company spent thousands and thousands of dollars on two different diving companies to retrieve the cars from the bottom of the river. They didn't do it. So he came up again. He bid for this job the first time. He bid for this job the second time. And he bid for the job the third time. And they're like, well, you know, I mean, what have we got to lose, right? He got all of the cars up. And actually, most of them were still drivable. He was paid enough where he bought his wife a new washing machine and a dryer, which she was grateful for because when he got that job, he dismantled the washing machine and took the washing machine motor for his diving suit. Promised that when he brought up all the cars, he would get her a new machine. And he did. He got paid good money for it. And not as much as the other guys did, by the way. But he got a new car out of the deal because one of the cars he brought up still worked. And he says, well, you know, I'll just take that car too as part of my payment. And they said, well, heck, why not? He's somebody that if you sign up for my email list, you will probably see a story maybe in a year or two as when I think he's got something or when I think I have finished letting him talk to me, if you will. Another inventor from Indiana you probably already know is Ralph Teeter, who invented cruise control. And if you don't, there's some books on Bard about Ralph Teeter. And I probably won't write about him because a lot of other people have written about him. You've got other authors like Reed Baird, who was a lawyer and a real estate agent and all that good stuff, and an author, and he's from the 1800s as well. William Reed was born in 1833. He was a music teacher and made a living throughout much of Indiana teaching music. He got married, had several children. He taught at the Indiana School for the Blind for a time. Now, he went blind at age 11, and his parents sent him to Kentucky because he predates this school for the blind in the state. So he went to the school in Louisville and came back, made a good living as a music teacher. When he started teaching at the school, he taught at the school, but he also taught music to private students. He did some performing, not much. When piano tuning was brought to the school, he was teaching and learning piano tuning at the same time. So by 1900s, he's making a living as a piano tuner. Let me see. We got a few more of the people here. I was just looking at my time here. Okay, so one of the things that the School for the Blind wanted to take credit for in like the 1880s and 1890s was that they had a whole bunch of preachers that they had turned out. Now, the School for the Blind was not a religious institute, but as with many schools for the blind, religion was a major part of your school day. You had chapel in the morning or prayers, and that's where morning announcements were. There was always services that you either attended at the school or you went out into the community and attended church. And for many of the schools for the blind, in Indiana in its early many years, same thing. You attended church. Your parents said what church you were going to go to, and you went to that church or that service, or were always mandated to be in chapel. So they loved to take credit for their preachers. They thought that was great. And they mentioned a lot of their broom makers. Now, I told you that broom makers were a big deal. And you've got several of them who actually had their own business where they employed sighted people. Like Toombs, he had his own broom shop. The other thing was the girls who went to the school for the blind. They were expected to make a living for themselves because, not that this was said this way, but this was kind of the way it was thought of at the time, is that, they're never going to get married. So if they're not going to get married, they need to support themselves. So what are they going to do? Well, music teaching was one of the big things. And of course, a lot of music teachers came out of the Indiana school. They taught them how to make lace, which was an important thing at the time because in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, a lot of the ladies' circles, they would make lace because to fix your outfit, freshen it up for the new year, if your cuffs were frayed or stained, you added a new set of lace to it, or a lace cuff, sewed lace onto the end of material that you used for a cuff and so on. And so there was a neck, same with neck lines as well. So there was a definite need, and a woman could make some money doing that, probably not live really great, but not too bad. But another interesting, especially after you get to about 1900, was telephone operator. Weren't too many telephone operators in Indiana at the turn of the century. Annie Downing was one of the first telephone operators, the blind telephone operators, and she was from Mattoon. And by 1900, she was operating a telephone switchboard for her community. Now, a Mr. Thompson, who graduated from the school in 1915, he was operating a switchboard for a major organization. But I thought was really kind of neat is there were three women who operated a switchboard from about 1915, around in there, through about the 1930s until it was really modernized and so on. And the first one was Minnie Winter, who operated it. She was much older than the others. She was part of the Alumni Association. She was an active person in her community. She was an excellent typist, and she taught music. And so when the school heard about this opportunity, they suggested Minnie that she go out there. And they were kind of hesitant, but they needed a telephone operator. Minnie said she could do it. They thought, well, what have we got to lose? And so she sat down with the sighted operator for a few days, and she wrote out everything, typed out everything in on her typewriter, and then typed out everything in Braille. And then pretty soon Sarah Young came out. She was a little younger than Minnie, but she would be the one that would be the relief operator. So the two blind women lived together. And then about 3, 4 years later comes Teresa Crack. Now, Teresa's a lot younger than these other women. And she was a little more mechanical. So whatever happened to Minnie and Sarah, I don't know. I can't find them after they leave. And it might have been, especially in Minnie's case, she might have passed away because she was probably about 35, 40 years older than Teresa. So Teresa comes and she keeps this job for many years. She has everything brailled her way, and the lines had expanded, of course. She ends up, after Sarah leaves the house, she ends up having two other women come and stay with her. One is a relief operator. One was a relative who probably needed a place to stay, a woman. That wasn't uncommon. If a woman had a job, she often helped support other single women who weren't quite as fortunate as her in her household. So Teresa keeps this job. She gets in a lot of newspaper articles because not only does she answer the phone day or night, but they called her kind of like a hound dog. The telephone system was the newspaper, if you will. It was their emergency broadcast system. If there were weather alerts, and they would call Teresa and they'd say, okay, get everybody, tell them that there's a tornado coming or a bad storm. She'd buzz everybody's lines until somebody answered. When there was an accident on a farm and they needed the doctor right away, she would call one exchange after the other, looking for the doctor and telling them, you got to get to so and so's farm. Or she would relay medical information over the phone to that farm when the doctor wasn't able to get there quickly so that they could at least stabilize the person. So they said that she could track down anybody in town anywhere, that she knew where to look for people. Indiana, of course, was a rural state, and you have farmers all over the place, blind farmers who had smaller, medium farms, and they were all over the state. They weren't just, oh, we've got a community where this guy is, we know he's a successful farmer, so we'll have a couple more blind farmers. And they didn't all live together either. Marcus Helsel was in Noble County, and you've got Byron Pribble. I like his name. He had 140 acres in Wells County. And John Wilson from Portland, Indiana, Elmer Gentry, and yeah, Thomas Smith. Now, there were a couple of Thomas Smiths, so I kind of wonder if there weren't two Thomas Smiths that were blind. But the one of the Thomas Smiths, he had gone blind later in life and was not happy about his situation. And so one day he drove up to his Baptist church and he parked his horse and buggy in front of the church and he prayed and then shot himself to death. So, you've got some sad stories there that are not all that great as well. I want to make sure I've got a little time for questions. There was one other guy I wanted to tell you about because he was a traveling salesman. He owned his own business. He graduated from the School for the Blind in the 1870s and he borrowed $200. He purchased a building and opened up a feed and granary company. He died when he was 30 years old on a train. The conductor helped him to his seat, sat down, and he was talking a little while with one passenger, and then it looked like he fell off to sleep, and the passenger thought he was sleeping, and then he noticed, geez, he's really kind of sitting there funny, and turned out he'd passed away. He was only 30 years old. He was newly married and he left an estate of $40,000. In today's money, that's $1.5 million that this kid made, and they didn't know what he was going to do because he wasn't musically inclined. But he did pretty well by opening up his own farm and granary business. So anyway, I wanted to just kind of give you guys a chance to ask questions if you want.
Okay, there's a couple of you that were on the phone that I muted, so you'll have to unmute before you can talk. And if you are on Zoom and you are muted, you're welcome to open and let's be kind and orderly and ask her questions and that. So.
No questions? I can talk a little more. I hear somebody?
Are there any hands raised, Deanne?
No, there's no hands raised. No
Okay.
hands raised.
All right. Well, then like I said, I wanted to get in a couple more people. Like I said, the School for the Blind really focused on the trade schools and I should say the trades rather than an education at first, although they did fairly well, I must say, especially as the years went on, because they did add to the school and so on. But they taught them how to be businessmen. And two of the guys that they taught them to be musicians and so on, their names were Fred Reeves and Frank James. And They performed together, that kind of thing. But they ended up opening up their own music store together because they actually could make a lot more money. And they didn't have to travel, which was another plus in that area. There were blind guys who opened up their own Notions stores. That's kind of like a variety store. That's what they call them, is a Notions store. So it's kind of like a variety store. And he started out, his name was Vimette Hatfield. And don't ask me where Vimette comes from. I have no idea, but I find that an interesting name. He sold newspapers, a common trade, although I have not tracked down Indiana's newspaper guys yet at all, but that was a common trade for getting started in business. And he opened up his own business, so it was a real store, not just selling newspapers on the street. And he incorporated his newspaper business into his store as well. Ed Yeaman, he actually moved to Illinois after he graduated and didn't have the best of luck, but he opened up his grocery stores. Did very well for himself as well. Now, I said there were a lot of piano tuners that came out of the School for the Blind, and there certainly were, and many of them did fairly well. There are a lot of folks who had their own business, but the first, probably the first 10 years, the school helped to get the graduates from the School for the Blind, from the piano tuning department, into piano houses. There were lots of piano houses where they built the pianos and the piano tuners tuned them before they were shipped out for the person who ordered and purchased them or sent to stores. Many people ordered them from a music house. When the salesman came to the door and said, "Hi, we'd like you to buy a piano, and here's what they're going to sound like. You're going to just love them to death." And then they go back to the factory and build the pianos for these people and then bring them to their home. Mail order pianos, if you will. So they had the school had an active part in helping their graduates for many years get a job. There were some actually public school teachers. Daniel Funderburg, Funder, not Thunder, but Funderburg. He taught in public schools. Mary Mahoney, she worked in a children's home, and the children's home, this one took in orphans and abandoned children or children that were taken away from their parents. And they had a school there, and she taught in that school. One of the most famous ones was James Freeman. Oh, the school just loved him. They promoted him up and down every one of their annual reports or any one of their major interviews on what blind people were doing in the state, because he was teaching languages in school. I mean, he knew like several different languages, French and German and Latin and this, and he would teach in the public schools, and then he would teach private lessons like during the summer and so on. Until about 1893 or so, they kind of distanced themselves from him because he was arrested for molesting children from an orphan's home. Well, he got a slap on the wrist, and another year or two later, he was arrested again for the same thing. And so the School for the Blind stopped talking about all their successful blind people using his name anymore. They didn't want to be associated with him. There's one in every bunch, you know? It just seems like you. What can you say? But there, as the years went by, women didn't do the fancy work near as much. They were focused on learning typing so that they could be typists in insurance companies and whatever. And several of the graduates did, women graduates did that. And you had a couple of blind editors. You know, I told you about John Donnell. The guy from Greensboro, the first state rep. Well, he actually owned two newspapers, and he was an editor, and he spoke out quite a bit in the newspapers on the issues that were important to him. He felt that immigration was a big issue, and sometimes he was for it, and sometimes he was against it. Kind of depended on where they were from. He wasn't too keen on folks coming to Cuba, coming from Cuba, but he didn't mind if they were coming from Puerto Rico. So I wasn't really sure what his concerns were about that, because I haven't really delved into him. But that would be a really interesting family history to figure out what made him such a proponent of Puerto Rico and so adamant about Cuba.
Peggy, this is Dee. I see that John or that Don and Jerry have their phone unmuted. Do you have something you want to share?
This has really been interesting. And are you familiar with there was a fellow that graduated from School for the Blind here later, of course, in the I forget when he graduated without getting out the book and looking, but his name was Forrest Goodenough, and he taught in the University in Texas.
I was going to
Science
say,
department.
somehow that name's familiar, but I don't associate him with Indiana.
Oh yeah,
He's a graduate
he's a graduate of
of the
our
Indian
School
School
for
for
the
the
Blind.
Blind.
I obviously haven't done very much on him, or I maybe just have him on a list. But I thought the name Goodenough was really fun.
But he's he was a I'd have to. I've got his name written in the book. I've got some of us from three of us from in the 1960s, part of the Alumni Association. We put together the names of all the graduates from 1906 forward. I don't have the ones from before that, but from 1906 forward, I have all the names of the graduates. And it took a while to get that all put together,
I'll bet it did.
but when I went to a, I was taking music to a retirement community, a nursing home, and one of the ladies in there was a an aunt, a great aunt or something, a brother like that, that to three nieces, nephew that had gone to the School for the Blind back in the 1860s, late 50,
Oh.
about 58 to 64, 65, something like that. I wish I could think of their names, but I can't remember what her name was. But she was in her 90s at the time. But these relatives of hers had gone to the school.
I think that's true. I have not done a deep dive at all on Indiana, so I can't say I'm anywhere near an authority. In fact, every time I say something about this was, I never say this was the first person to, or this was the only person to, because as soon as I do that, somebody comes up with somebody else, which is a great thing. Because, I'm
One
sorry,
of
go.
the things about Tom Hasbrook was when he was in the General Assembly, he actually got a bill passed so that a blind person could take someone of their choice to assist them in voting.
Yes, he did. And he's responsible in many ways for the white cane laws in the state as well.
Yes, that is true. Right.
We knew him.
He
We
seemed like
met
an
him, and
interesting kind of guy.
he was, and he was a good card player. That's what I'm told.
Well, I'm sure his kids kept him busy doing that kind of stuff.
Well, they did,
They did. He had what, six kids?
Something like
yeah,
that,
they
yeah.
had six. Yeah. And the one of them, actually, the youngest one, who was a daughter, actually worked for rehab services for the state of Indiana for many years.
Yeah,
And there were a couple.
he had what, something like three lawyers, two doctors, and a teacher, or something like that, or I forget exactly,
Yeah, the
but he
youngest
was.
one later on became a teacher, but she actually worked as a rehab counselor to start with.
Yeah, he was proud of that. All of his kids went to college and became professionals.
Right, they did.
Yeah, his one of his sons is a doctor right here in Indy.
I talked to one of his sons before writing my piece. And he was very willing to share.
Oh yeah, they
Oh
are.
yeah. Yeah,
I tried, yeah, I try to
we know
talk
some of
to
them.
ancestors if I can, which is hard because a lot of our blind folks were told, our lo ancestors were told, you can't have children. And
Yeah.
so there was nobody to leave their to perpetuate their legacy. There was nobody to tell their stories, which is really sad.
Well, this is Dee. Don and Jerry are two of our oldest members of the of ACB of Indiana. They are also alumnus of the School for the Blind, and some of our oldest alumnus too still living.
So have you guys put up a website, your alumni association put up a website with your history? 'Cause your alumni association has got a long history.
It does. It does.
One of the things that bothers me a lot is our history is going into the trash, literally going into the trash. And it is, I think, up to us in order to ensure that it doesn't. The state of Iowa took over the Board of Regents took over the buildings and everything and sold the Iowa School for the Blind. The Iowa School for the Blind dated back to the 1850s and had literally rooms of artifacts, papers, files, boxes, you name it. And I'll bet you that when and they would not let any, I even offered to be an advisor to this group about what to save and what to pitch. I said, well, if you want not going to let me, then let the Alumni Association. They would not. So they got people who knew nothing about the Iowa School for the Blind, and they threw out our history. That history had the Alumni Association helped to build the Home for the Blind in Iowa, which turned out to be a disaster, but that's a whole nother story. The Alumni Association met every year at the School for the Blind. The organizations of blind people met around the country and formed, as you know, AAWB and so on. But the Iowa College for the Blind was where the American Foundation for the Blind was born. And there was correspondence and I mean, the stuff, the hist our history. That wasn't just about Iowa, but about the rest of the country, was thrown out because they wanted to make sure that they respected the privacy of those people. I'm thinking, most of the people in those files are long dead. It's not like you're going to offend
Yeah,
them.
you're right. They're not going to know.
They're probably going to want somebody to remember who they were. So it's it's a shame. The North Dakota School for the Blind, it threw out a lot of its stuff, and it just happened to be that when I was starting my family genealogy stuff, I wrote to them and said, "Hey, could I have a copy of my mom's file from the North Dakota School for the Blind?" And they said, "Oh, sure," and they just sent it to me. And I'm thinking, "Geez, I wasn't into the blind history stuff." Now I'm thinking I should have asked for all of her girlfriend's files and everything, and that would have been really. I bet they would have given them to me. They weren't that worried about privacy. But literally, you look at our schools for the blind, you look at the homes for the blind that are going away. When everything gets incorporated from private to state, things get in basements and then pretty soon they're just tossed. Here in Colorado, while doing my research here in Colorado on blind history, first of all, I had to get a whole bunch of it digitized. And you can say what you want about COVID, but I happen to think COVID did us a few good things. And one of them was that I found well over 100 volunteers who didn't have anything to do all day and were very happy to transcribe documents. We had them all digitized, and then I and another lady, we just feed them files and feed them files, and they would transcribe them and put them into Word and Word documents. But in doing that research, I discovered that blind people in our state do not have a footprint in our history. And I am working to change that. So I'm working with the History Colorado Museum. The state library does not seem to be too interested, but maybe they'll be jealous by the time I'm done and they may get on their on their high horse. But I am putting together, for the History Museum, they just don't want stuff. And they don't want books, and they don't want minutes. They want stories. So I have been collecting artifacts. For example, I turned in what I call my technology dump a couple of weeks ago to them. This is my third contribution to the History Library, History Museum. And I turned in an opticon. And with that opticon, I told about the lady who donated it and what she used it for. But I also had three more little vignettes from other blind people I knew in Colorado who used an opticon and what they used it for. The same with some of the other technologies. I have, they are really interested in slates and styluses, which I find really fascinating. So I'm finding different kinds of slates and styluses and who owned them, what they did. Some of them taught Braille. So eventually when they have their disability month or when they have their exhibit on disability, they're going to have some really cool artifacts, but they're also going to have the stories from behind them. And I think that is, in my opinion, more more personal for us getting our story out. And we need to do that. We need to save the material. The organization, it always was sort of state run, but it was the Workshop for the Blind through the 1950s to the 1960s here in Denver. And it's now a it's kind of a rehab facility. They're thinking about moving into smaller quarters, and I am trying to get them to let me help them transfer that material out of their basement. Because if they've got some old stuff there, I mean, I told them, I will help you put the stories together. If you tell me what it is, or you let me look at it, I will figure it out. And I will tell the story. Because I do have access to documentation about people who worked at the sheltered shop. I do have documentation about the products that they made, how they sold them, when they sold them. For example, if we could find some of their old brooms, some of the broom sellers here in Colorado made good money. They hired people to drive their, they would get these big station wagon cars that could hold like 9 people, but they'd fill them up with brooms and drive them out to the small towns and sell them to stores and make good money. We can complain about subminimum wage, and that certainly is definitely a bad thing. But when blind people were in control more of the broom manufacturing, whether it be through an agency or on their own, That was a good business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I've run out of time. I've run over time.
Yeah, well, we started at 5 after, and it's now 5 after. And I want to thank you, Peggy, for coming and talking to us today and sharing your stories. And I'm glad that Don and Jerry were able to unmute and share a little bit with you too. Maybe we'll have you back again sometime.
And if you want to join my email list, just shoot me an email to theblindhistorylady@gmail.com, and I will add you to my list.
All right. Is there anything else you want to say, Rita?
Well, you may not want this on the recording, but I wanted to ask Peggy,